OK, so I'll again be talking about the wave function of the universe. Now, since we are dealing with a quantum theory of gravity, we should be talking about some wave function. And since it's a theory of gravity, this wave function should pertain to some geometries, should be a function of geometries. And so the simplest and old idea, and since you're laughing because this is an old idea, that hasn't gone very far, but I'd like to see whether we can, what we can learn about this idea from ADS-CFT and other more modern ideas. I think it's a very important idea in quantum gravity to know what's the wave function and how we should think about the universe as a quantum system. So the simplest idea is you think about the wave function as a function of the spatial three geometries. And so in, let's say, some mini superspace approximation where you only focus on the overall scale factor of the metric, this is, let's say, a wave function of A. And as a as an example you probably all know, if you take the Sitter space, if you take gravity with a positive cosmological constant, and you take the spatial metric to be an S3, and then you can write an effective Lagrange and effective action for this scale factor A, and then you find that you have effectively like a quantum mechanics of 1 degree of freedom, and so you have some potential for A, and the potential looks like this. So it's since A is the scale factor, its kinetic term is inverted. So here the region where it's negative, that comes from the positive cosmological constant. This positive region comes from the spatial curvature of S3. And then you can you look for a zero energy solution. So there is a constraint that the energy should be zero. You look for the zero energy solution. And there will be regions of this wave function which are oscillating and some regions which are damped, okay, in which the variation of the wave function is exponential. So in other words, in the allowed regions of this potential, you'll have oscillating wave functions. And in the forbidden regions, you have exponentially varying wave functions. And so now, if you pick a particular wave function here, you can identify these oscillating pieces with Lorentzian pieces in the geometry. So that would be the Sitter universe that is either expanding or contracting. And you can identify these exponentially varying pieces with Euclidean pieces of the wave function. But these two, so what Hartle and Hawking have pointed out is that you shouldn't think of these two as completely independent, Lorentzian and Euclidean, but you should actually sort of join them together. And you should think of them as different parts of the same wave function. So the Euclidean pieces, the Euclidean geometries are related to the damped pieces of the wave functions, and the Lorentzian geometries are related to the oscillating pieces of the wave function. Now, the reason these ideas could not be made more concrete is, well, we can't even define perturbation theory around this geometry, so we cannot really define this wave function since the theory is not renormalizable. There are some unclear issues like how do we normalize these wave functions and so on. And also one question one can ask is how do we pick a solution of this Wheeler-DeWitt equation? The Wheeler-DeWitt equation is the equation obeyed by this wave function. And Hartle and Hawking made this interesting proposal of using defining the Euclidean pieces of the wave function, that is the pieces that are exponentially damped, by taking manifolds with no boundary. Okay? And this would define these wave functions in the damped pieces, in the damped regions, to leading order in h bar. Now, they said, well, maybe determining the wave function completely in the forbidden regions should determine the wave function in the Lorentzian region. So therefore, we'll have a unique wave function for the universe. OK, so that's the old story. Now, what happens if we consider negative cosmological constant? So with negative cosmological constant, we have a picture for the effect. And again, we look at what happens with the overall scale factor. So what we find is that the negative cosmological constant flips the sign of the potential here in the large A region, so it makes it positive. And if we had a sphere, it would be positive throughout this region. And if we had other fields or we have hyperbolic space, it can be negative in some region here. Okay, so let's first try to understand the region here far away. So here, this is a forbidden region. So the corresponding semi-classical, the wave function will be semi-classically approximated by a Euclidean solution. So we have a Euclidean solution, which is a Euclidean anti-de-Sitter space or hyperbolic space. And we can write the wave function as this real exponentially varying piece that we said we always had in the forbidden region, times some piece that varies a little less slowly as a function of A. And it's a function of the geometry. Now here the new insight is, well, that was understood several years ago, is that using this Euclidean ADS-CFT, when we take the large A limit, we can actually compute the large A limit, little a limit, so the large scale factor limit of this prefactor, and that should be equal to the partition function of a conformal field theory. And this conformal field theory will depend on the asymptotic boundary conditions of that we impose on the wave function. So in other words, it depends on the same arguments that psi depends. So we lose one of the arguments of psi, which is the scale factor, because we're looking at this boundary region where A is infinity. But other than that, we have here a large number of parameters we can vary, and we can explore the dependence of the wave function as a function of these parameters. So, given a given boundary condition, the conformal field theory is completely determined. And so you compute the that partition function, and that gives a unique answer for this partition function. So you are not free to change the answer for the partition function of the conformal field theory. It's completely determined in terms of the boundary data. That, I think, is suggesting that, again, this idea of a unique wave function for the universe is reasonable, at least in this limiting case. Now, if in cases where a non-singular Euclidean geometry exists, it gives the right answer. In the sense, by the right answer, I mean the answer which seems to agree with the conformal field theory, or which is consistent with the conformal field theory. Now, well, of course, the problem that we had with the wave function of the universe was that we didn't know how to define it beyond perturbation theory. Of course, in this case, the conformal field theory gives you a complete way of defining it, at least, but it only gives a special limit. So this is an important drawback. Now, it's true that in some cases we have a completely non-singular Euclidean geometry that we can use to compute these wave functions. But in many other cases, there are singularities in the interior, which are geometric singularities, but that string that are configurations that are not singular in string theory. And so string theory allows us to compute this sort of semi-classical wave function in many more situations than we would if we only had gravity. This fact that the wave function seems to be unique and given by this Hartle-Hawking proposal in the exterior seems to, in the Euclidean regions, seems to suggest that maybe in the Lorentzian region there is also a unique wave function when we have compact geometries. Oh, okay. So what I mean here is that it doesn't give us the full dependence of the wave function on A, but only gives us the A equal to infinity limit. Okay. It also is telling us that this wave function at least makes sense in this limit. We don't know whether the concept of wave function is the right concept away from this limit, but at least in this limit it gives us the right concept. Yeah.
I'm not real clear what the geometry we're talking about is.
I've talked only about this region, but for simplicity, let's take them to be positively curved. Okay. So you have a sphere, and then the full geometry just would be simply Euclidean ideas. So that's the geometry.
I'm saying Euclidean. Yeah. I don't understand what it's supposed to attach onto in the Minkowski.
Well, Lorentzian, we haven't yet talked about Lorentzian. Yeah. So here I'm going to later talk, make contact with Lorentzian regions in the interior. But the idea is that here we're exploring one branch of the wave function. So the idea you should have in mind is that this is only one branch. And this is the idea in Howland and Hawkins' paper, that this is only one branch. We should, in principle, this is connected with all kinds of Lorentzian geometries. And if we explore the Euclidean, if we know the function in all the Euclidean branches, maybe we know the function in Lorentzian branches. OK, so I'm going to try to use this idea of a unique wave function to shed some insight on the interior of evaporating black holes. And this is, again, work we did with Gary Horowitz. And so the idea is we have an evaporating black hole, we have matter falling in, we have a horizon, we have Hawking radiation. Now, if we think about the spatial slices of the interior of the black hole, they basically look like compact geometries. Because here we have a sphere times, let's say, time, but the size of the sphere shrink as the black hole evaporates. So this the spatial geometry in the interior of the black holes is effectively compact. Now, the standard description of these black holes is that we have some matter that falls in, and then we have some quantum field that propagates in the background of the black hole. This quantum field starts in the vacuum, and at late times we can describe this vacuum becomes this Unruh state. And so here at late times we have the infalling matter times the Unruh state. This Unruh state is an entangled state between particles living in the Hilbert space in the interior of the black hole and particles living in the Hilbert space in the exterior of the black hole. And the whole here for us, the whole Hilbert space of the interior of the black hole, we are going to divide it into two pieces. One will be the Hilbert space where the Hawking partners live, which have a sort of negative Schwarzschild time energy, but this energy is really momentum in the interior. And the pieces that come from matter we threw in that had positive energy in the outside, and these are pieces which have positive energy in, with respect to Schwarzschild time in the interior. Anyway, this is not a strict separation. I mean, interactions will mix these two, but it's useful to think about it conceptually for what we're going to do later. Now, so this is the usual description, and then we say that everything falls here through the singularity, and we can't access what falls through the singularity. So in the end, we get a thermal density matrix in H out. Okay, and so that was this information problem. Now, that is assuming that the interior of a black hole can exist in many possible wave functions, in the sense that there are all kinds of possible quantum states that can fall through this singularity. Now, let's make a different assumption. Let's say that the interior can be in a unique wave function, that there is a unique wave function for this for the universe in the interior of the black hole, for the interior of the black hole. And this wave function is an entangled state between the states of the matter that we throw in and these partners of the Hawking modes that live in the interior of the black hole. Now, we're going to assume that this is it's going to be entangled through S will be a unitary matrix. And it's a random. This matrix will be random and very complicated. It needs to be very complicated in order not to run into problems. And it's very this matrix, of course, depends on the basis you use for describing these states. And the idea is that it is very complicated in the usual Fock basis that we use.
Well, Yes.
The gravitational field is included in here. Yeah, so here among these Hawking particles is the gravitational field, and it's also included here.
What are the two
subspaces,
the two factor spaces?
One is the spaces of the, let's see. Okay, so one is the partners of the Hawking modes, which have negative Schwarzschild energy, and the other are particles that have positive Schwarzschild energy, so in the interior. So this energy is really momentum. So these are just particles with either positive or negative momentum in time in the interior. in by time I mean Schwarzschild time, which is really space.
And what is the unique, what is the yes. unique state in this book standing
in? It's this state. This is the state, the unique state in which the black hole can be in.
Okay.
Right? So. Right, right. So this here we can have lots of different states here, but there is a corresponding state here. This is entangled with some corresponding state here.
In just means the incoming particles?
No, in means the Hawking modes that fall into the black hole. Okay, so let me draw this little picture here. So we have the matter, right? The things that we throw from the outside. So in the interior, any particle that we throw in will have positive, let's say, Schwarzschild energy, so we'll be moving in one direction in time here. Here we have the creation of a Hawking pair, so one particle goes into the interior, that lives in H-in, so here, stuff here lives in H-matter, this stuff lives in H-in, and here this lives in H-out. So there are three Hilbert spaces in this story. And basically, what will happen is that this matrix S relates the matter and the these Hawking modes, and this Unruh state relates, entangles these two here, things here. Now, this idea that there is this unique final state for black holes, that's a modification of standard quantum mechanics. In standard quantum mechanics, you can go into any possible final state. But this is not a new modification. It was studied by many people, among them Hartle, in this cosmological constant context, because he wanted to have some more time-symmetric boundary conditions. So the idea is that you start with this state that was the matter times the Unruh state, and then you somehow impose or project the state on this black hole state. Here you have three Hilbert spaces. Here this is an entangled space into two of the Hilbert spaces. And so in the end you get this final state in this out Hilbert space. And so the state you get out depends on this complicated matrix. So you have the Hawking radiation will be a specific complicated state. And so if you had some way in your unitary gravity theory to calculate what comes out of the black hole, then you can somehow run this backwards and calculate this matrix S that lives at the singularity. Now, and I'm using observation, I'm not sure what to make of it, is we heard a talk by Thibault Damour saying that when we approach the singularity, we have this mixed master behavior, this BKL oscillations and so on. And so we had this classical chaotic system. And normally when we have classical chaos, the Hilbert the Hamiltonian becomes some random matrix. So it, well, one could speculate that maybe the fact that this matrix is completely random is related to the classical chaotic behavior approaching a singularity. But well, that's a speculation. Not that this is not a speculation.
The conventional S matrix for in states and out states is going to be unitary.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes. Yeah, so you see, after you do this, so we start with this state psi matter, and then we end with this state. So that's the final thing. So this was designed to, but it was designed to be unitary. This here we are assuming things are unitary. And we're saying, well, how do we need, what modification do we need to do in order to get a unitary answer?
No free will behind the horizon. You're forced to end up in a
Yeah, you're forced. Yeah, this is, that's right. And what I was trying to emphasize is the fact that this is very consistent with these ideas of a unique wave function of the universe. It's not, let's see. Okay, this I already showed. So here, I guess usually, well, we've known for a long time, well, we think that black hole evaporation should be unitary, and it's not exactly clear how that's supposed to happen. So here the idea is that it is the presence of the singularity that is enforcing this final state boundary condition. Now, there was this idea of black hole complementarity, that it shouldn't be possible to make measurements here in for this matter that falls in and for the outgoing quant at the same time. And these ideas are consistent with that. I mean, naively you would think that they are not, because here when we are at some slice here, we have three copies of the Hilbert space. However, as Harl emphasized, when we are dealing with a closed system and even a system with final boundary conditions, the correct way to think about it is to think about observables that decohere. So that decohere means that you can define sensible probabilities by just looking at the amplitudes. And so here what happens is that if you have some observable here, which will be given by some projection operator in the matter sector, and some observable out here, that is some projection operator in the out sector. So this evolution that we have matter, and then we have this S matrix, and then we have this Unruh state, this can be represented in terms of matrices, saying that we have the matter state, it's acted on by this black hole state S, and then we have this Unruh state that makes it out into the out Hilbert space. And so then we would have the matter operator would be acting here, and this out operator would be acting out here, and we'll have this S complicated S matrix in between the two, and that will imply that simple operators like made out of local fields and so on that live in the Fock space, that have a simple expression in terms of the Fock space, will not decohere. Okay, it's like they don't commute. Okay, now, of course, once one talks about a given final state, one is always worried about the arrow of time. So this idea that the black holes would be in a given final state is not new, and people thought, oh, maybe there would be a unique state, and then the question is, well, maybe time flows in a different direction in the interior of a black hole. So I'll try to argue that that's not the case. So the idea is that somebody who falls into the black hole, so an experimentalist that falls into the black hole, has a small number of degrees of freedom that he can access, because he has a small time to make the experiment. And so he will be having projection operators, so his measurements will involve projection operators and will act on a very small subset of the Hilbert space. So he will not be making measurements on the whole black hole state, only on a subsector of it. So if he makes some measurement, he will have to average over the things he hasn't measured, so all these in Hawking falling quanta that are falling somewhere else, and so on. And after you average over that part of the Hilbert space, since this matrix S was basically random, in the subspace of the experimentalist, this boundary condition looks like a final, instead of a final state, it's a final density matrix. And now, what does this density matrix look like in the observer's Hilbert space? Well, it will just look like an identity matrix, because this matrix S was random. I mean, this matrix S is random but fixed. It's just complicated. So this will imply that the arrow of time will flow forward in the interior of the black hole. And not only, I mean, this is very important, because the arrow of time flowing forward means that when we solve, for example, the classical equations that determine what happens with the black hole and so on, we impose the usual conditions that perturbations travel forward and so on. So the final state boundary condition is a state in the Hilbert space. It's not a final boundary condition on the fields. I mean, if we put a simple final boundary condition on the fields, like the field equal to some value, that's a very simple matrix. It's not a very complicated matrix in the Hilbert space, because it would be, roughly speaking, diagonal in the Fock basis. So that's not a complicated enough matrix. Okay, so I think these ideas of single state follow quite naturally if you think that black hole evaporation is unitary. And so if you believe in them, so if you accept them, then you would conclude that you cannot have things like this, so that you form a black hole, and out of the middle of the black hole, you have a second asymptotic region, let's say the Sitter universe that inflates and comes out of here and so on. So this you can't have. Now, more precisely, what one should say is that that there cannot be any information transfer from the outside to this interior asymptotic region. So we cannot send a message to, let's say, this inflating universe by encoding all the values of the coupling constants. So since any information transfer would be forbidden, then we could just as well think about the creation of the second asymptotic region from nothing. So out of some bubble nucleation or whatever, we created the second asymptotic region. So in any, so I think this is a problem for cosmological situations which go through some singularity that hope to somehow that quantum mechanics or string theory will be non-singular. This rings a bell and say, well, maybe this is not possible. I mean, strictly speaking, what I have been talking about here was for compact universes. Probably one could extend some of these ideas for non-compact spatial slices. I'm not exactly sure how to do it in a sensible way. Now, in these aperiodic and cyclic models, the singularities are very similar to the singularities that appear in some black holes. In particular, the singularities of black holes in IDS3. So if you cannot go through, there is no information transfer for these IDS3 black holes, then you can't transfer the information of the, in these models you need to transfer the information that you had some fluctuations in the contracting phase to the expanding phase. So now, again, what I have said was for these compact spatial slices here, maybe there is some subtlety if the slices are non-compact. I'm not sure. Okay, now I'd like to talk about some confusion I have. All that previous stuff was very clear. No. So let's go back to negative cosmological constant and try to look for an effective potential for a situation where the effective potential for the scale factor would allow a Lorentzian solution. And so that can be achieved in some cases. So it is possible to choose the spatial slice or some fields on the spatial slice so that there is a Euclidean solution out here and a Lorentzian solution out here. Now, how the Euclidean solution looks like, again, asymptotically IDS space or locally IDS space. And here in the middle is something which is not IDS, but joins two asymptotically IDS regions. So it looks very much like the usual wormholes in flat space, but now this one is in IDS. And the Lorentzian solution is just you cut this one here and you analytically continue. So you get collapsing universes. So you get compact big crunch and big bang and big crunch cosmologies. Now, these Euclidean geometries are a bit puzzling from the point of view of ADS-CFT because it seems that the two sides are correlated. So it seems that you could, I've been saying that the conformal field theory is completely determined by the boundary conditions. And so there is a completely clear value for what the, for the partition function of the conformal field theory. So here we would have two conformal field theories they would be completely independent because the conformal field theory Lagrangian is determined just in terms of the boundary condition and not in terms of the geometry in the interior. So from the field theory, we expect that these two sides should not be correlated. Okay, this problem is similar, very similar to the problem that ordinary wormholes pose in flat space, that you could have correlations between two distant regions. Now, this since this is puzzling, Witten and Yao went through the trouble of proving that this could not be done, but they made some assumptions. So they assume that you cannot find such Euclidean geometries if boundaries have positive curvature and you have just pure gravity with negative cosmological constant in the bulk. Now we can go around this. So there are two ways of going around this. So one is violating A and the second is violating B. Okay. Violate A, so we take spatial sections which are quotients of hyperbolic space, that is surfaces with constant negative curvature, and it's very easy. So you can write this geometry. This is just a quotient of ADS space. It has the features we discussed before. Now, ordinarily, you would say, well, okay, you can find this geometry, but there isn't a well-defined conformal field theory that is dual to this, because in any conformal field theory, you will have a scalar field that is conformally coupled, and negative curvature implies you have negative mass for that scalar field, and so you will not have a well-defined conformal field theory. And that's true, so this it's hard to do in higher dimensions. However, in ADS3, where you have a 2D conformal field theory, we know that 2D conformal field theories can exist on an arbitrary Riemann surface. Now here there is a sort of technical detail, which is that this is an arbitrary, a conformal field theory can exist on any Riemann surface if the conformal field theory has a compact target space, so if it is an ordinary conformal field theory. Now, you can ensure, you can find examples of ADS-CFT where the conformal field theory has a compact target space, and an example is take ADS 3 cross S 3 cross K3 and arrange the charges suitable ways and go to generic pointing moduli space, then the conformal field theory will have a compact target space. So that conformal field theory, you can put it on a negatively curved surface, and so it's well defined. Okay. Now you can also violate B. B was the assumption that we have pure gravity. So we can just have, and the simplest modification is to add some gauge fields. So we can have gravity plus gauge fields. And so you can do this in, let's say, in four dimensions by you take the S3 here, and the gauge fields you add is you add here a meron on S3. So a meron is a configuration where the SU2 gauge connections is equal to the SU to the left invariant spin connection on S3. And here, you just take this on the S3, and basically what happens is that the presence of these gauge fields prevents the three-sphere from collapsing. And this can be embedded in ADS4 cross, well, in the supergravity theories related to ADS4 cross S7, and the field theory would be an M2 brain field theory, which has a twist in the normal bundle. Now, a similar thing can be done in ADS5 cross S5, where we put an instanton of an SU2 gauge field. Actually, we also need to put an anti-instanton for some technical reasons. I mean, it's a bit hard to find the geometry where you don't excite any scalar fields and you are consistent with Jan Simons terms that come from supergravity. But you can find solutions. So these are some examples of the solutions we can find. Now, there are some features of these solutions. So they are all, I think it's reasonable to restrict to solutions that are asymptotically well-defined conformal field theories, so that is, they don't have any instability asymptotically. Now, they typically have some perturbative negative modes. So when you expand around these geometries, you can have perturbations that lower the action, so they are subtle points in this approximation. In some cases, one can get rid of the perturbative instabilities, but and so one has examples without perturbative instabilities. But all the examples we've been able to come up with, they are always unstable under creation of some brains. So these are not brains that go to infinity, but you create some brains, and it is possible to take these geometries that we discussed here and create some brains that live here in some region in between and that lower the action. Anyway, so they are not the complete minimum of the action. They are somehow metastable. We tried to find a supersymmetric example that we could then understand better, but we didn't find any supersymmetric example. There is a hand-waving argument that there shouldn't be a supersymmetric example, which is that if you think about this as a one-dimensional problem where you go from the left to the right, and you have first-order field equations that come from a superpotential, so the gradient, the flow in this, in all the parameters is the gradient of the superpotential. If you have a time-symmetric solution, then the derivatives will vanish here, and if they vanish here, they would vanish everywhere. So that's a hand-waving argument. It's not true. It's not a complete rigorous argument, because if the superpotential has a square root singularity or something like that, then you can possibly violate. Now, how should we interpret these solutions? What I like to say is that I would like to trust the filter intuition that these two sides are completely decoupled, and that actually, if you were to compute the correlation functions of two operators in two sides, and you really summed over all geometries, you will find that they completely decoupled. That, at least, if the field theory is well-defined field theory. I think this is if this is true, another interesting observation is that these Euclidean geometries are connected with these collapsing geometries. So by computing, we said that the partition function of this conformal field theory far away is the wave function of this Euclidean geometry. So through this connection, it's also giving us some information about the wave function of these Lorentzian geometries. So I think it is very important to understand these relationships better to see whether we can really gain some insight about the wave function of these kinds of universes. Of these collapsing universes. I think this is a problem to be understood better, and don't have anything more to say. The conclusions is that we saw. Yeah. You have these Euclidean geometries, right? This is a moment of time of let's say space reflection symmetry, so you can analytically continue in that, okay, and that gives you these collapsing geometries. Mm-hmm. Well, they are compact universes. I mean, they are not very interesting cosmologically. Apparently, maybe you can embed the whole cosmology in the interior and make the size very big. But I think they are interested in trying to understand some cosmological situations in a non-perturbative, maybe you can understand them in a non-perturbative way in a bit, and say something about the initial singularity and so on. That's why I think they're interesting. So we saw how this idea that the wave function is unique is connected with the black hole information problem. It's also related to the wormhole problem, because if you really cut open this wormhole and say, well, that what you should really be doing is you should really be thinking about it this way, you are really probing the wave function of this Euclidean, of these Lorentzian geometries, then they better be, if they are fixed, then that will lead to fixed coefficients in the effective action if you think about it in the Coleman way. It's very important to understand that a single wave function doesn't imply a single macroscopic state. So that you can have a sum of different macroscopic states containing the same wave function. Now, having said all this, we still don't know what the right language is to describe psi, to describe this wave function, or whether it even makes sense. We know we can describe it for a equal to infinity, but we don't know what happens when the scale factor is less than infinity. Thank you. I think before answering the questions, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank all the organizers, at least all the organizers that I should be thanking.
I would like to thank the rest of the organizers. Any questions?
So to go back to this statement of yours that time continues to run forwards because this matrix is very complicated.
Yes.
I mean, it worries me a little bit that something like this might be basis dependent. It might look very complicated.
It certainly depends. Yeah. So the direction of time in this case depends on the observer and what measurements you do.
So somehow the infalling observer is in a basis where it looks very complicated, and that's why for him.
Yeah, that's right. So the infalling observer feels time going forward because he only accesses a small number of the degrees of freedom.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
More questions?
Yeah.
Slava, hold on.
Why did you forbid this configuration when you have the Sitter universe inside of black hole? It actually was your choice, or there is some deep reason for that?
Well, the I forbid it in the sense that this picture only makes sense, that picture only makes sense if there is a way to transfer information from the outside to the De Sitter space.
Yeah.
Right? If there is no way to transfer information, then we should just shouldn't draw this picture.
No, right. Inside,
well, yeah, if we fall into a black hole and we see a Sitter universe, all this stuff I'm saying would be incorrect. But I'm just saying that the idea of unitarity, there is this idea that when you form a black hole and it evaporates, from the point of view of the outside observer, this evolution should be unitary.
But so,
In principle, also black hole can have stable remnant with the mass of the order of the Planckian mass. It contradicts nothing.
Right. So this was some intuition that, let's say, a few years ago, was some intuition that came from the idea that the S matrix in string theory should be unitary. It was sort of a principle. But now we have some conjectures that give us a non-perturbative way to compute this S matrix, where the answer would be unitary. So, for example, if you take a black hole in ADS, so take an anti-Sitter space that should be dual to a conformal field theory. The conformal field theory is unitary. They are things evolve according to usual Hamiltonian, etc. So if you throw in if you form a little black hole and it evaporates, okay, this evolution is unitary in the conformal field theory. Therefore,
the remnant, stable remnant with the mass of Planckian mass is prohibited. When black hole evaporates,
yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
There can be left some remnant with the Planckian mass. Or how you would describe this picture?
Well. I mean, most of the energy.
You go away, right?
Well, yeah. So you need remnants that have lots of entropy, right?
Yeah.
Now, yeah, that's right. Well, what happens is normally in string theory, the particles that have of order Planck mass that we understand are these deep brains or very massive string states that they all don't have that much entropy, and sort of are continuously connected to perturbation theory in a way. So all the Planck mass objects that we understand have low entropy. And if you try to put many of them together and so on, you raise the mass and you increase the entropy.
More questions?
Maybe I should formulate a similar question in a different way. Well, suppose you have a universe which right now is expanding, okay? Mm-hmm. Suppose you have a distribution of matter which looks like that. You have a piece of space which is inflating right now,
right now,
okay? And then there are some other parts of the universe which contain dark matter and everything, and there is such a profile of distribution that when we go further and further and further at a large distance from us, we will see that there this profile of matter becomes very small. So for all practical purposes right now, we're an expanding universe, and some part of it is even inflating. But then when we go much further away, our world horizon will touch this place where there is no matter. Then from the point of view of distribution of matter, you have positive distribution of matter with a delta rho over rho of the order of 1 on the scale of the horizon. And from the point of view of geometry, I would expect this thing to collapse. However, this part would contain inflationary universe inside it.
Right.
So that's...
Right. So the idea is that this would be a problem if you could, in this flat space that you have far away. So the question is, in this flat space that you can have far away, can you form a region that will look like the expanding universe we have now? Okay? And if these ideas are correct, then you cannot. And classically, you cannot. So classically, you cannot take a flat region, throw something in. This is something that Guth and Farhi explored. So you cannot start from something non-singular and then create a universe. So the universe
is
that we did not start non-singular. Our universe starts singular.
Okay, well. This has to do with this question about the infinite spatial slice. So the idea is, if these ideas can be extended to this infinite spatial slice, then this state from which the universe expands is unique, and then it contains some flat space region, some region where it looks like ours, and so on. And if we don't have any good technique for computing what comes out of this singularity, then I cannot give a very good answer for what comes out of it. I mean, I cannot add anything to the standard discussion. I'm just here. I think I'm adding something to the discussion of what happens with black holes that you can form from the outside and where you can form new universes for this. I think that's where I'm saying something about.
Yeah. More question?
Can you just repeat the statement again? So you can't start with non-singular initial conditions and make an expanding universe starting in flat space?
Yeah, that's right.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank all the speakers for giving exceptionally good talks all week long.